Hello.
Hi.
Scario. How you doing, man?
Good, man. How are you?
Oh, good. Well, as geopolitical powers shift globally, where do we stand as a country? Where do we stand as a continent? With the tag rivalry between USA and China, again, where does that leave us? Our national digital policies and our civic spaces. Here to help us unpack and understand the geopolitical spaces is Dr. Rosano. How are you doing, Doctor?
Almost Doctor.
Oh,
almost
Dr. Rosano. Gabriella Rosano. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. Thanks for having us today. We're excited to get angry about politics.
Hey, put me on that bandwagon. Anytime we get to bash politics, I'd like to jump on and just throw my little 2 cents.
You know, the stock market bounce was all part of Trump's plan after those tariff scares. I mean, it went down, but they got the bounce. So it was part of the plan, you know?
Yeah.
That man is quite the classical one, I'm telling you.
It's the art of the deal. The trick about a deal is to, like, before you go into negotiating with someone who'd probably be willing to negotiate, you just steamroll them violently. And then say, now let's negotiate. And then people are so much more receptive to what you have to say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, just to sort of give us a soft landing, if somebody's listening out there who, just like me, doesn't know anything about politics, what are geopolitical powers and how are they impacting us as a country, as South Africa?
Well, you know, I'm more of a digital specialist and a political legal, political, economics, it all affects technology. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And I think part of the exciting thing about working in this space is working in a space, a technology space, that people don't view as politicized. People don't view as social and as incredibly politicized, incredibly social. In its impacts and in its influences and what influences it. And, you know, at a geopolitical level, there are big influences in the technology space and in the regional space as well, the African space.
Yeah.
That I think is really worth keeping abreast of. None of it's unconnected. How technology develops is in response to a whole lot of, you know, standard social, political, and economic influences that we investigate elsewhere and then for some reason don't think counts in the digital and technology space, but it does.
Can you maybe be a little more specific about that? Like in your own work, how you've seen, you know, local civic tech efforts somehow being squeezed by these broader global issues, whether it's big tech ownership or global platform governance, anything you can sort of highlight there?
I mean, I think one of the major influences in terms of data and digital governance, and we can talk about how that impacts like at the, you know, project level, is, you know, there's a general pattern of what we call digital colonialism. Difficult word when you have Lisp, but, and data extractivism, right? So the major technologies are being developed elsewhere. The big data technologies, the big data-driven technologies, which are all the technologies that really count, they are being developed elsewhere. Africa and the region is simply a market for those tools rather than, you know, a significant enough developer of its own technologies to reap what we call digital dividends. And so there's also this confluence, there's a general pattern of extraction, but that extraction is data, both data and, of course, economic, right? Because, you know, the products aren't housed here. They're not being taxed here. And so you have that kind of, so the it's that general pattern of extractivism and digital colonialism. I think it's very influential, and that's a big geopolitical force. The big tech, the major big tech companies that we talk about are all data driven. Meta, Amazon, all the boring ones, some of the ones you don't even know, you know, some of the big industrial companies and stuff are actually data driven businesses. And so there, you know, there are elements to which we're not just left behind, but exploited. And that's something to be conscious of, right?
It's not a new thing necessarily, is it? I mean, the extraction process has been there for decades through other sectors like the minerals and stuff. Are we seeing the same pattern with data? Data being mined, products being created, and just to be sold back to the continent.
Yes.
That is a scary sight. The rivalry between USA and China, how is it impacting us? The tech rivalry, to be specific. Not the tariffs.
I mean, we've all been enjoying the dollar ZAR exchange rate recently. Which is also, like, let's be honest, that's related. These issues are not related. A big part of the competition between China and the US isn't just trade competition. It is specifically about the technological patterns that are emerging. You know what I mean? So then these aren't unrelated issues. I think you're seeing, it's really interesting in the sense that, you know, China has a particular approach to regulation of technologies. It has closed networks. You know, it uses technology and digital surveillance as a mechanism of social control. Very, very advanced ways. That is, you know, a big pattern in terms of how it develops or utilizes technology, but at the same time is a profound user of innovation and technology to build its economic system, right? You know, part of the reason manufacturing is so advanced, it's supply chains, but it's also technology. You know what I mean? And the US has always had a completely laissez-faire approach to technology and technology regulation, right? We trust these tech bros, you know, like they know what they're doing. Yeah, they're a little bit into eugenics, but we don't mind. Like, how bad can we get? You know what I mean? And so it's had a laser, so it has a different approach to dealing with digital regulations, eh? But understands, of course, because of the profound impact that big tech has had on their economy, the value of digital innovation. But one of the things that makes the US climate, I always thought the US climate quite unique. I got taken on a U.S. State Department tour of Silicon Valley, Washington, D.C., and some of the smaller regional innovation projects. And I can tell you, it was quite cool. I mean, I had to stay in Columbus, Ohio.
Oh.
It's very flat, you know? Yeah.
But that's like the Northern Cape.
Yeah. You know, and also very large sizes of soda, like grotesquely large, you know, like diabetes
style. They enjoy their soda there.
They do. And in doing those tours, what was interesting for me was it wasn't the regulatory difference. So I think there's a big general belief, you know, there is a laissez-faire promotion of growth, right, in the US. Like, don't regulate, things will be amazing, you know, like, and that's what creates growth. But the big difference between the States, Silicon Valley and like our versions of Silicon Cape is that they have a financial market that is just completely directed at funding technologies, that is absolutely laser focused on funding technologies at high risk, regardless of return, you know, and that comes with its own problems. It comes with its own problems of the kind of culture it creates, you know, fail fast. What's that? What's Zuckerberg's fail fast and what? Move fast and break things. I mean,
yes, you have to fail fast.
Yeah. And we say that all the time. And then, but I try and not, you know, it's not a corporate ethos.
No, no. But, the furthest thing from a corporate corporate ethos.
Yeah.
But how it sounds like China has figured out a proper model of governing their technologies, the internet at large. It sounds like the US is there or thereabout. Sounds like they don't care. They let the regulations go about for in the interest of innovation. Where are we as South Africa? Are we governing the internet appropriately, or are we governing as per the geopolitical shifts?
You know, I think so much of regulation has to do with your political landscape. And I see domestically in South Africa in particular, I'm reminded sometimes I forget the, you know, the national in African National Congress, you know, there's a lot about how policy is driven and regulation is driven that is very heavily influenced by that more traditional, like nationalist kind of and centrist agenda that, you know, that the ANC emerged from. And you see it in attempts to, you know, have very centralized regulation in national government, largely in national government. That's a bit of an anathema to the needs of technology and data in many ways. You know, it can be a conflict, I think. You saw it in like the original version, to put it into policy terms. Yeah. There was a cloud policy, a national cloud policy that was promoted that came out of the Department of Telecommunications. And you could see that there was an attempt to think, well, you know, obviously data is important. Cloud technologies are important. Cloud infrastructure and data infrastructure is important. So what we need to do is control that and center the control of that quickly. Regardless of whether we have both the literal capacity, like the infrastructure, and the human capacities and digital capacities to really benefit from using that data. Mm. And that's something that's been a big part of the conversations on data regulation, is that to extract value from data isn't about owning that data or holding that data, right? It's about controlling that data and having the capacity to extract value from it, you know, if that makes sense. That it's about, until we have those capacities, worrying too much about who owns what and where it sits you don't gain anything. And so in the cloud policy, there are attempts to create like state ownership of all data generated in South Africa. And what does that even mean? What does ownership of data mean? Do you know what I mean? I can't sell, like, people talk about people trading data sets. You know what I mean? But like, if you consider how much most data is created and generated, it's within products, right? And products talk to other products. And most data-driven businesses aren't selling data. They are building a business atop of the learnings on that data. Do you know what I mean? And so you see that tension in the South African regulatory space, okay. I think.
Yeah, I think in this series, we've touched on the issue of ownership a few times, actually, in terms of our data and what that actually means. I mean, even if you look at the cloud systems like AWS or Microsoft or something like that, yes, sure, we may be using the cloud here, but we're still using foreign infrastructure. I'm less concerned about all that, actually. I'm more thinking about these big platforms being kind of like geopolitical players in their own right, in the sense that they're, you know, you take last year, for example, as a specific example, we had numerous elections last year. Their power to shape the discourse or the conversation rather between within a particular country that's occurring on their platforms, I found was a far more problematic than, you know, my personal data or the country's personal data. I mean, you know, in your own work with OpenUp, you've got things like, you've built a few tools around elections and, you know, citizen participation. WASIMaps was actually one of the first ones I used many, many years ago. How's that? How are you guys thinking about it? Like, how are you thinking about that particular issue with using these big platforms, but then at the same time trying to bring this participation a little bit within, you know, our own infrastructure? Actually, I shouldn't even say infrastructure. I just mean within our own interests, where we can actually do something with the data.
Yeah, I mean, and you'll see, we were talking a little bit about this today with a colleague of ours who works with the unions. You'll see how a lot of our work is importantly not trying to act as what you call an infomediary, or, you know, all these cool terms that everybody uses, you know, is realizing that, you know, the provision of data and information is so important, but the translation of that data and information into something meaningful is a political and a social act, which is frequently done by people who aren't us, you know, and that's where it has power. And I think it sounds so trite, but to think of data and technology as a political tool, do you know, and as a civic and political tool, is an important way to reframe. It's understanding that it's political and not thinking that it's, you know, because other people are doing that translation for you. And in so doing are absolutely positing a particular kind of agenda. I mean, the platforms regulate feeds, right? So they regulate the content that's available to you. They're doing that regulation with a particular agenda in mind, and that's to their commercial model, which is different for different kinds of, you know, entities. How Spotify controls your data is different to how Facebook does it, because their business models are different, but, you know, the attention economy is driven on making you irritated, either making you irritated. And so you get these, what do you call them? You know, all these echo chambers, all that stuff. But that is because those technologies are fueled on a particular business objective. And so we need to reimagine the provision of data and information for political and social aims. Like, that needs to be what drives us to collate the data, what drives us to make it open. And when we do that, we completely reimagine what good technology looks like, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to think data is neutral, but we know the interpretation of it is not. So,
And data isn't neutral, but a data set is not, you know? And so how do you extract that? Do you know what I mean? A data set is, if you think about it, a construction of single points. So what points you choose to include and what points you choose not to include is fundamentally a decision. And every decision is an act of power, is something I like to, you know, talk about with my team. Every decision is an act of power or taking power. And how you construct a data set is, filled with bias, which is where, you know, and this is where the conversations about algorithmic bias comes in. Who is represented? Who is not represented? What, you know, those are fundamentally, again, social political questions, I think.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
All right. In my head, I'm trying to find the opportunity that lies for young creators, right? I think we're living in a time now where there's a lot of young people who are participating online through other big tech products. And if they're listening to this conversation, what should they be concerned about? That's the first part of the question. The second part is, if the digital civic space is sort of the lifeline to democracy, how threatened is it?
I mean, well, one thing to talk about with young people is, so I work a lot with digital startups and those kinds of things. And I don't think a single young person has ever come to me with the idea for a fintech or do you know what I mean? Like every single project young people in this country bring to me, which they envision as an innovation and a digital innovation, is focused on positive social impact. It's
right.
And I think, so I suppose what I'd say to young people is, you know, thank goodness you exist, and thank goodness there's something about South African young people and how intrinsically they understand the potential of technology and data as a positive social tool that I love. And I don't see it everywhere. You know what I mean? It's not in every country. And I think in that sense, we have an advantage. But, you know, we build civic technologies. So those are technologies and many other technologies, but technologies that, you know, on some level integrate citizens with government and participation between those two groups. And I think there are many ways that technology can facilitate or advance, create efficiencies in that space, right? You have a better form, whatever. But I'm loath to suggest that technology is the answer to civic participation. That I think using civic, like, I think the answer to civic participation is creating a better civic environment. Do you know what I mean? Encouraging better civic action. And technology is part of that, you know?
Okay.
But like, I think you've seen, Posner wrote about it in the States, but you've seen it in South Africa, the general degrading of like a civic society or civil society, you know? There are no Rotary clubs anymore. People don't go get together to discuss, you know, things. But there are communities who still have weekly street committee meetings, you know, so the, you know, they are a lot of grassroots opportunities for more direct political activity. But I think there's work to be done on the civic space. And thinking about how technology can or can't influence that, I think is useful. But I think the problem is, you know, weaknesses in the civic space.
So are you saying the digital civic space in itself is not at any threat? Looking at the shift, the power shift, and all those concerns around data protections, are you saying that regardless of what the geopolitics look like, these activists online who keep speaking against the shifts, there's still protection there. There shouldn't be any concerns.
No, that's not what I was saying. Sorry. Oh. I just think. No, I would say digital civic space is also shrinking, you know, and a lot of that is because of platform reliance, right? A lot of that is because we rely on platforms that are developed elsewhere and we have very little control of. You know, these platforms are not communally owned. Some of them are, some very exciting examples are, do you know what I mean? And I think creatively thinking the lessons we've learned in like membership-based organizations and, you know, the like different kinds of structures for imagining how we develop technology is very useful. But no, that space is definitely shrinking as well.
Okay.
Or maybe more challenging. But I think a lot of that comes from platform reliance. And the opportunity is in rethinking how we can create technologies cohesively and collaboratively to, you know, forward civic aims. And I think that's only becoming, you know, the mainstreaming of technical skills is growing, you know, more and more diverse institutionally and at the human level. And that's an opportunity to drive more, you know, locally developed and also like a community developed, you know, within specific kinds of civic communities developed activity.
Do you find your tools that you guys build at OpenUp, how's the usage there? Do you find they're getting used quite a lot, or there's lots of demand as such?
There is. I mean, we probably, the greatest usage of tools are tools we've helped to develop with existing communities of users, you know? Like if you look at something like, so we work with the Parliamentary Monitoring Group and who provides all the parliamentary information as a nonprofit. I mean, mind blowing when you think about it, really. And we maintain those technologies and we've built out different aspects of those. But I mean, that has millions of users. Like every year, 3 million users, unique users and stuff like that. So, I mean, you know, these technologies have a real footprint. But that footprint exists not because we developed an open data platform. It's because PMG, which is a civic institution, has built trust with Parliament and a community over, you know, how long has it been around? A long time.
Long time.
You know, and so using technology to enhance those existing communities is where strength lies. You know, it's not trying to create you can create new kinds of civic communities in different spaces as well. But, you know, our most successful projects have been those kinds of collaborations, I think. But also sometimes,
I just had a comment. I mean, in my background, we used to use it a little bit in terms of our coverage of stories and so forth. I would have liked to have seen it being used more, even before you guys built the tools around it. Because even now, like, as sort of larger legacy media companies start, you know, their model starts crumbling a little bit, and there's quite a lot of feudal startups that come up. From that, a little less examples here, but in terms of the states and things where the economy makes a lot more sense for smaller startups is, you know, they're using AI and tools to go through like lots of community stuff, parliament stuff, local city hall things, and they're just finding the most amazing stories and kind of almost reviving that sense of community and civic participation simply because the tools are able to generate the stories. Or it makes it much easier for an individual to generate the stories than it has been for a long time. We used to just do it by the sheer numbers of individuals, but since we don't do that anymore, simply because the economy doesn't, the business model doesn't support it, you find that these tools. That's why I almost feel like you're downplaying the value of tech in this space, because I think the tech could actually re-enable quite a lot of civic participation. Yes, I agree with you that the community would be there anyway, but I think tech is really a part of almost reviving it, making it much easier for people to participate than it hasn't been, say, for the last 10, 15 years.
I mean, I think that's part of that is because I just take for granted. Do you know what I mean? It's also when you are the people who have the technical skills, you know, I just take for granted that there is always a technological way to make things more efficient and more innovative. And I think, you know, one thing we talked about, and sometimes that means like underplaying, but exactly what we do, which is to build technologies every day, you know, that help people because we see profound value in it. But what we're trying to shift is the idea that it has value in it because it's technology and not that it has value in it because it's achieved a civic and social aim, and that's what makes it important. And I think, you know, we constantly have been, I mean, Eddie, my co-founder, used to go on, he's like, we need more civic education in schools. That was like his solution to everything. Was like, we need civics in schools. I mean, I first learned about the layers of government in my first year of law school, you know? He has a point.
He does have a point, yeah. But yeah. Good luck trying to change the school system.
It's not, I mean,
it's president said we must get teachers to go off for 2 years, re-educate them, and then put them back in schools again. So good luck with that. Again, back to the entrepreneurs or digital creators in the space. What do you see as threats in the civic space, and what are the opportunities that currently lie, considering the power shifts that we currently see now? Want to create products, right? I want to build solutions, but I'm fearful of where my data sits, and I don't know how to align what I'm creating. Do I align it with what I see in America? Do I align this with what I see happening in China? As a young entrepreneur in this country, when I think of civic-centered solutions, how should I be positioning my products and solutions in this current climate?
Yeah, I mean, you align it to your community, you know? And so all these little, like every little startup that tells me about how they notice that their mother has this problem. I mean, that is gold. That is, you know, where the ideas start. You know, the point is that there are geopolitical things that will influence the deployment of technology and some of the realities of deploying technology. But in terms of what makes innovation great, it's context, you know? Yeah. And I think there are huge opportunities, particularly in the sort of digital and startup space. For me, I see a lot of the gaps in the sort of the business, the B2B market. You know, I think a lot of people, and that's so you can identify a problem, but a lot of people automatically try and imagine, you know, how to introduce that to a customer, you know, and our customer base, I mean, we have a big population, but there, you know, there are only so many people who are, you know, dispersing funds on mats. And there's like I lost you for a bit. There's like a disconnect. Yeah, I just can't see you. But there's a lot. I think there's real opportunity in B2B that is underestimated. As an opportunity, if we're talking like straight digital startup, like,
yeah,
I would think that's, you know, especially in like the informal economy and third economy, you know, that kind of like peripheral economy that actually makes everything go.
Okay. You know? So the investments to the tech startups is not impacted, you'd say. So let's say this guy has a great civic tech solution. It's well contextualized. It's solving a local problem. However, he's at the point where he wants to sort of choose where to deploy, whether through tech that's hosted in the US, through tech that's hosted in China, and he's looking at the geopolitical space change and is wondering which is the safe bet. How does he position this product in this case?
Well, I mean, let's get something quite clear. The investment is the problem. I mean, in the first quarter of this year, in terms of AI investment, less than 1% of investments in AI startups went to Africa, let alone South Africa. Do you know what I mean? So external investment funds aren't flowing in for our technology development, you know.
There are
challenges in accessing public funding for this stuff. I mean, they're little, you know, there are at least acknowledgements that this is something that happens. And listen, I think the public sector can be a major driver of innovation as well through investment. So, you know, I'd promote it wholeheartedly, but it's not a huge, you know, it's not like reaping dividends. And in terms of like, you know, our financial investments, you know, and VC and that kind of thing. I'm not so much an expert, but I do deal with a lot of, you know, my friends in the private sector. And it's still a very conservative investment climate, like business investment climate. And that extends to, you know, digital investment. And, you know, particularly like, and particularly for scaling, you know, trying to take something like from a small idea up, that it's that scaling phase that's really lacking. I mean, I think you, all you can do is look first at domestic markets, try and build a business, focus on revenue actually, and first, and take it from there. Because there are challenges to try and extend. Like, if you're trying to sell, like, a, do a digital-based business to Europe, like, trying to manage the GDPR compliance, which is the data protection compliance with the, you know, European Union, is really, really difficult. Really, really difficult. Really, really complex and expensive. And, you know, our South Africa, we, while we have a Protection of Personal Information Act, which is relatively similar to the GDPR, there's still no adequacy agreement that means that our businesses can easily, you know, they don't take for granted that we've got the data, you know, protection regulations here yet. So that's a challenge, you know, to meet that, that kind of compliance. I mean, but that's Europe, of course. and I mean, you know, I think trying to get anything to an American market now would be very challenging.
Yeah. That market is very different.
Yes. I mean, yeah, China's might be different, but only for a little while they try and screw each other.
I don't think China's an option. Eh?
So
just to bring in a little more, ask you a little bit of a personal question. Has the idea of, I mean, you've been around for a little while, you've been involved with Open Up for a while. The stuff that you guys have built, say, over the last, I don't know, over almost, what, 15 years, roundabout?
10. Look, careful.
Okay. How's your idea of civic tech change in that time? There's been quite a lot of tech changes in that time. So how's your idea about what you do, what services you provide, your intentions really as Open Up? What is, how has that changed? How has that shifted for you?
I mean, that's quite a fun thing to discuss because that talks a little bit, I think, to, you know, the social economy or the economy of trying to, you know, do social impact work and technologies, or but civic work more broadly. And I mean, if you think about it, that space is dominated by like nonprofits, and nonprofits are dominated by grant funding. And there are incredible challenges to being reliant on grant funding. We have pivoted recently to a model where we are about 70% revenue funded and 30% grant funded. Part of the reason we can do that is because we have technical skills. And I do think it is more challenging for other kinds of civic groups and social impact groups, you know, to market themselves, you know, in a revenue context, but there are models for doing that. And part of the reason we've pivoted is because that kind of development funding and grant funding environment is an anathema to organizational development and organizational strength. It's just not designed to build strong institutions. It's designed to deliver projects, you know, almost discounted projects. And I think it's been a real limitation on South African civil society. I feel almost that in many senses that development funding, grant funding environment has created a sort of taken away from our sort of our activist space on some levels. I think a lot of the people who've gone into the NGO space and then, you know, pull their hair out every day, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, would have been in a political space and be, you know, more. And I do think on some level that that has contributed to the some degenerations in our civic environment. But I mean, that's a maybe the controversial perspective, but that's how I feel. And so we're building up those projects, and we will start a for-profit arm, I think, you know, that then feeds all profits into further social development. Because I'd like an environment where we were better able to subsidize innovation support to community-based groups and grassroots organizations that will never be able to afford to invest in technology. And so those communities who would so benefit from it, you know, who's going to subsidize that? It's not going to be the grant funders, right? So yeah, that's a lot of where we're reimagining.
Interesting.
Our world.
Nice.
Yeah. So with this impact of shifting geopolitics, we now have the presidency of the G20, or rather the chair of the G20. We are a BRICS member. Does this two positions strengthen our ability to create policies around data sovereignty, how to structure regulations, or are they just positions that we are holding in the space with no impact?
I mean, I can't say that the G20 thing isn't influential because they invited me to speak yesterday. So you've got to know they're on the right path. Do you know what I mean? Like, very forward thinking, you know? So let's just take that as a given on the G20 participation. But I do think representation matters. You know, I do think African representation matters. And, you know, South Africa has many failings. But
well documented too.
Yeah, exhaustively documented, which is another strength.
Right, we can document.
Yeah, is I do think holding space in the G20, holding space in BRICS is important. And I do, and I think it has an influence. And I do think, I mean, I've been involved in policy at the regional level, so with the African Union. And there is an African spirit and an African drive in digital and data policy that's really important. And that's actually, like I said, very community-centered, very impact-driven. And I think that's a great vision. I mean, there are challenges to how the, you know, many African countries engage in, you know, lobbying on international forums because there's splits. There's some like major standard splits in the lobbying environment that you can't get around, you know, like, you know, the conflict, not the conflicts, but, you know, North Africa versus the rest of Africa, South African exceptionalism, which often makes us, you know, a very uncomfortable regional partner, the strength of ECOWAS, you know, versus, you know, the SADC, say, French-speaking countries versus Portuguese-speaking countries, you know, the tendency of French-speaking countries to align in international lobbying with France's positions, you know, these things are all well spoken about. These are fundamental tensions. But I do think, you know, that the impetus behind the African free trade area conversations is an important one. And I do see, you know, a building, I mean, it's always been there since, you know, when you were talking about African Union and the formation of the African Union, but the spirit to like Pan-Africanism, there is something in it. There is some consistency in the acknowledgement that data and digital policy only has value if it's about driving social development. And I like that. And I think it's profoundly important that we stay represented in the international sphere. Because I think, well, firstly, we have all the young people. And secondly, we have all the conscience and the soul. So
I think that helps.
Yeah.
All right, man.
Well, that was interesting. It was, in fact, you've given me quite a lot to think about. I'm going to have to go back and look at our notes. We've had quite a. So you're the fifth interview we've had in this series as such. So there's lots of just, solidifying the things we've talked about throughout the series, but also just some new ideas around, what's the bigger picture here for South Africa? Mm-hmm. What's the bigger picture for the region? Yeah, very nice, very good. Thanks for joining us. That was interesting.
It was a lot. I enjoyed that thoroughly.
Did you? Good, me too.
Yeah, I mean, no wonder the G20 has invited you to speak. I mean, we...
Thank you so much for having us.
All right. Dr. Gabriela Rezona, thank you so much for joining us. It was an absolute pleasure learning and taking insights from you.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. Bye.